All right, we are in, what are we, Mark chapter 7 still? Mark chapter 7. We just got done with the clean and unclean controversy, where Jesus declares all foods clean, which has ramifications for people as well. What we find right after that is you see the Syrophoenician woman in verse 24 of chapter 7, where she comes asking Jesus to help heal her daughter of what? An unclean spirit. So you know the conversation is still continuing about clean, unclean. Ultimately, I argued yesterday that the woman does not argue her way into a healing, but instead Jesus heals her on her faith, which was not necessarily, not necessarily what the disciples were excited about. Why? Because we're in Gentile territory, and this is a Gentile woman. We are in the region of Tyre and Sidon, and this is a Syrophoenician woman, a Greek at that. So this is not somebody the disciples are real excited about giving any sort of benevolence towards whatsoever. Which is one of the reasons why I suggested yesterday that I think that Jesus calls her a dog because he is enacting or saying out loud what the disciples were thinking as a means of rebuking them in a sense, indirectly. Yes? Say that again.
Why is a demon spirit even interested in a Gentile?
Maybe explain that question more to me.
If they are not even up for salvation or anything like that, or even worth anything to what the demons consider worthy of God, then what? Why would they even spend their time on the Gentiles?
Yeah, because it matches the goal of the kingdom of Satan. The goal of the kingdom of Satan is destruction. The goal of the kingdom of Satan is not possession. It is destruction. If there is possession that occurs in any way, shape, or form, it is to get to the goal of destruction. Therefore, if he can utilize people that are more susceptible to him in order to accomplish his goals, he will. So, for us to reduce down the battle between Satan and Jesus merely to salvation, although that's the major part of it, we could overlook the key goal of Satan's kingdom, and that is to destroy. That is his goal. Destroy people, destroy relationships with God, with other people, destroy the person themselves. Multiple levels of destruction you can see there. The relationship here, the relationship here, and then the relationship with inside of the person. So the same thing that he accomplished in the garden is the same goal that still motivates him today. He's going to utilize these people to accomplish what he wants, and ultimately that is destruction of more people. So if they're more susceptible and open to it, that's where he's going to use them as a launching pad. Same reason why Jesus goes to the synagogues to start preaching. You know, it's a good place to launch your ministry. Why would you, if you're the kingdom of Satan and these people are already opened up to you, why would you not go to them first? So, So he'll launch his ministry against the Jews through the Gentiles, which is pretty good war tactic. Good question. Ultimately, though, I don't believe that Jesus is calling the woman a dog because that's what he believes, because his actions seem to betray that, both before this account in chapter 5, as well as within this account, because he does heal the woman. Instead, I think he's articulating the bigotry that comes with the clean and unclean prejudice that the disciples are still holding on to. And ultimately, I think that what follows will continue to build upon that argument. Because I think what we have that follows is reinforcing what I'm suggesting there with this kind of vague or odd interaction. Does that make sense? I'm not asking if you agree with me. I'm asking if you understand where I'm moving. Okay? So, what follows next, obviously, as what I've already said, I think is reinforcing what Jesus is bringing out of the disciples, and that is that the unclean, clean issue is about people, and the disciples have a problem with the bigotry towards the Gentiles outside of them, for they are unclean people, they are dirty people living in a dirty place. Verse 30, she went home and found her child lying on the bed and the demon gone. Jesus, though, does for her what the disciples would not have been okay with. Then Jesus left the vicinity of Tyre and went through Sidon down to the Sea of Galilee and into the region of the Decapolis. We traced that on the map yesterday. But and while it does move across the region, what is significant theologically about where he is moving? From where to where? From what type of territory to what type of territory? Gentile territory to Gentile territory, right? Because the Decapolis is a highly Hellenized region. Remember, on the other side of the Jordan. Do you guys know what I mean by Hellenized region? Highly Romanized, highly looks a lot like the Greek and Roman empires. The allegiance to the Roman Empire means a lot to them. And really the reason why it means a lot to them is because they're on the eastern edge of the empire. For just on the other side of the Euphrates is the Parthian Empire. We're talking just right across the road. Does that make sense? The Parthian Empire is the key evil empire, the anti-Roman Empire. So if you're right on the edge, you're going to make sure that your allegiance to Rome is made very clear. So if you're on the edge, is this making sense politically? Okay. Sometimes the blank stares, I can't tell if you're tired or if you're confused. So just every once in a while, I'll just throw one of these out there. But if you're nodding to sleep, then I'll call you on that. So he moves from Gentile territory to Gentile territory. We still have theology that's embedded into the territory he's moving. Because I'm going to argue once again that the conversation technically hasn't shifted. So they go into the Decapolis. Verse 32. There some people brought to him a man who was deaf and could hardly talk. And they begged him to place his hand on the man. Notice the word begged again. The word begged we consistently see in Gentile territory. First time we see it is with the Gerasene demoniac. Then we've just seen it once again with the woman. And now we see it once again here with the people in the Decapolis. They begged him to place his hand on him. Now here is the question I want us to keep in mind. Why this miracle right after what we've just encountered? We've just been on a situation of clean and unclean that's led to an interaction with the Syrophoenician woman that's now going to lead to the healing of a deaf and mute man. And the question I want you to keep in the back of your mind is why? Remember, your exegetical paper, that's what I want you to answer the question for, right? If my passage was gone, what would be missing? If you can answer that question, then you should be able to tell me why Mark put it there to begin with. If you only have so much place on a scroll, if you're writing out a story, and you actually have a theological purpose, every placement of every story has a reason, has a purpose. And I think this one does too. And we'll ask that what it is. We'll answer that question in a bit. After he took him aside, away from the crowd, Jesus put his fingers into the man's ears. Then he spit and touched the man's tongue. This is a weird story, isn't it? As a matter of fact, yeah. The fact that it is a weird story, coming off of another weird story, coming off of a major event, should tell us something that has a purpose. Okay? He looked up to heaven and with a deep sigh said to him, Ephphatha, which means be opened. It's kind of, Ephphatha may be an onomatopoeia. Anybody know what an onomatopoeia is? It's a word that whenever you say, it actually sounds like the word that you're saying, or the what you're or like whoosh. That word is an onomatopoeia, or kazuntite. Some people even think that that's an onomatopoeia because the way in which you're saying God bless you may be mimicking the way in which somebody has just sneezed. Anyway, Ephphatha, a deep sigh. It's filled with so many breathy tones that it may be mimicking, even in a sense, the deep sigh that he's just let out. Ephphatha, be opened. What is significant about the parenthetical note? We've already talked about this once before, but what does it tell us? Yes, that the audience is not familiar with the language in which he's just used. It is an Aramaic that he's speaking. And as a result, because we're writing to a predominantly Roman society, the word Ephphatha probably would miss, they would probably not understand what it meant if he didn't explain it to them. So he explains it to them, and it means be opened. At this, the man's ears were opened, his tongue was loosed, and he began to speak plainly. Jesus commanded them not to tell anyone, but the more he did so, the more they kept talking about it, disobeying Jesus. People were overwhelmed with amazement. He has done everything well, they said, even makes the deaf hear and the mute speak. Okay, play with it for a while. Why do you think that this miracle is where it is? Why is there? What's its purpose? Exactly right. That's what I think is happening. Is that this miracle, just like the previous account, is more about the disciples' position in the clean and unclean controversy than it is about the miracle itself. For the disciples are hearing the message, but they don't have ears to hear. do they? For whenever the disciples speak, or whenever what they are thinking or where their hearts are spoken for them, it comes out as if they really don't know how to talk about this at all. Right? Is this making sense? The disciples just don't get it. And you have this very strange and weird miracle right after. I'm not saying the miracle didn't happen. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is why does Mark place it here? Because I think the disciples are like deaf mutes right now when it comes to their understanding of the kingdom. They just don't get it. They, although they're close to Jesus, simply do not have ears to hear or eyes to see. But that's, again, the reason why this same concept of ears to hear, eyes to see is what ends in verse 37 with this quotation, this allusion to Isaiah 35, 5 through 6. Isaiah 35, 5 through 6 is this allusion to the word, or to the quote, "He has done everything well. He even makes the deaf hear and the mute speak." This concept of establishing a kingdom attached to the hearing and the seeing is what's embedded in this particular phrase, or in this quotation or allusion. In particular, let me read to you Isaiah 35, 5 through 6. Right before that, we have pronouncements of judgment against Israel, like every other quotation, it seems like, from any of the prophets. When you see a lot of the prophetic quotations in the Gospels, most of the time when you read the context, it's something that gets to either the climax right after the judgment, or it is right at the edge of the judgment, where there's judgment of Israel that's pronounced, but the hope is now being come realized in Jesus. And that's why the quotation seems to come up. A lot of the time. Obviously, you just need to check the context. Isaiah 35, 5 through 6 says this: "Then will the eyes after their judgment's pronounced," and then they talk about the hope that is coming in the establishment of the kingdom. It says, "Then, when the kingdom is established, then will the eyes of the blind be opened, and the ears of the deaf unstopped. Then the lame will leap like a deer, and the mute tongue will shout for joy." And what's significant about this to me is that we will have the healing of a blind person in 21 verses. Which seems to, in some sense, bracket in the disciples and where they're at. Because what we're going to find here in just a little bit with the blind man that's going to be healed is, I think, once again, it's a sign act describing where the disciples are at in their understanding of the kingdom. So does everybody understand my premises here? These are important because when we launch into this very next scene in Mark chapter 8, verse 1, it's going to be really important to understand where the disciples are at in the whole clean, unclean issue. Is there any questions about that? No? Everybody following me? All right. What class are we in? Mark chapter 8, verse 1. It's 8 o'clock, not 7. Okay. "During those days, another large crowd gathered." Where are we? We're still in the Decapolis, which is Gentile region. Actually, in the Greek, Mark adds the word "again." Again during those days, another crowd, or again a large crowd, gathered. What is the word "again" for? Because Jesus has never been in this region whenever there was a large crowd gathering around him. So why is he using the word "again"? What could it be pointing to? Is this the first time, though, that Jesus ever had a large crowd gather around him? No. But when were some of the other times? Chapter 3, where else? Okay, feeding of the 5,000, right? Now, but what is the difference between this scene and those scenes? We're in Gentile territory. The word "again" then is somewhat odd because of the territory that we're in. And yet it's not odd because that's the way Jesus' ministry has been functioning throughout all the Jewish territory up until this point. Now that will become more significant once we start piecing together what Mark is doing in this particular scene. "During those days, another large crowd gathered. Since they had nothing to eat, Jesus called his disciples to him and said..." Does this sound familiar so far? What does it sound like? What? Feeding of the 5,000, which was in Jewish, chapter 6, in Jewish territory. I'm going to be hammering on this over and over and over. You're going to say, "This sounds redundant." Yes, because I want you to get the point. Okay? Sounds familiar. He says, though, I have compassion for these people. Why would that be odd? First of all, flip back to chapter 6. Same word for compassion is used in chapter 6. Same exact word that's used in chapter 6 for the feeding of the 5,000 is now being used here for the feeding of the 4,000. What do you notice, though, the difference? In particular, I'm thinking of verse 35-ish. Who is the one showing concern in the feeding of the 5,000 for the people? Disciples. Who is the one showing concern for the feeding of the 4,000, or for the people, the feeding of the 4,000? Why? What's the difference? Yeah. The same situation seems to be developing. They're in this place. All these people are gathering. They're following Jesus. And all of a sudden, Jesus says, man, I have a concern for them. I have compassion for them. Specifically, he says, they have already been with me 3 days and have nothing to eat. If I send them home hungry, they will collapse on the way because some of them have come a long distance. We've seen the word again. We've seen the same word now for compassion. And now we've seen that the compassion is geared towards the people, but this time from Jesus. Now, why isn't the scene totally mimicked in the disciples showing concern for the people here in chapter 8? Because they are dirty, unclean people in a dirty, unclean place. And it would be odd for them to be experiencing compassion to the people that they want the Messiah to wipe out. You see in this? They don't want compassion from the Messiah going towards the Gentiles. They want the Gentiles to receive the judgment they deserve. Because it is the Gentiles that have held them in exile. It is the Gentiles that are oppressing them. It is the Gentiles that are the problem. And they already are having to deal with the fact that Gentiles are following Jesus right now. But now that they're 3 days out, maybe they're thinking, who cares if they starve to death? They're dirty, unclean people. And Jesus says, but I have compassion for them. Moving on, verse 4. His disciples answered, but where in this remote place can anyone get enough bread to feed them? Now before we go to the question, notice the word they use, remote place. What is that word? What is that word? How do we translate? Or what Greek word is that we translate other words? It's desert. Wilderness. The exact same word that's used to describe the people in Acts, or in, oh, good grief. Mark chapter 6. Same word. What's Mark doing so far at the beginning of this account? What's he doing? He's kind of comparing. He's making sure we're not missing the connections, isn't he? He's saying, again, the people were following. I had the same compassion. It was for these people that were going to be starving. We are all in a remote place. He's saying, do you get the similarities? Is anybody following this? You get the similarities. Same thing's happening, but what's the key difference? Gentile territory. Now, we can ask, why did the disciples ask this question to begin with? Although the answer seems somewhat self-evident, does it not? Why did the disciples ask, but where in this remote place can anyone get enough bread to feed them? That seems like an odd question in light of chapter 6, doesn't it? Because we know there's only 4,000 people here, and there were 5,000 in chapter 6. There were 5,000 in chapter 6, but they're going, how are we going to feed all these people? It's not that they have forgotten the miracle. It's that their bigotry that's embedded in the clean and unclean issue is causing them to be deaf and dumb to the message of the kingdom. They do not see how this message of the Messiah, the redeeming king that's coming to bring his people out of exile, could be anything positive towards these dirty, unclean Gentiles. Therefore, when Jesus does this miracle in Jewish territory, it makes sense. Why? Because Jesus is functioning as the new Moses. Is he not? What did Moses do for the people in the remote place? He gave them manna, and they're going, yes. Because he's creating a new people of God. Therefore, for the Jewish territory, it makes beautiful sense. Great theological sense. But for a Gentile territory? How did Moses deal with the Gentiles? In his day and age, how did he deal with the Gentiles? He excluded them. If Moses was the writer of the laws, receiving of the laws, he is the originator of their clean and unclean issue. He is the one that articulated it for God. How else? Think back even before the Exodus. How were Gentiles handled? Well, the Israelites were the slaves under the Gentiles at one point under Egypt, right? How did Moses interact with them? He initially was one of them, then left them for 40 years, comes back and does what? Kills them. Doesn't he? The 10 plagues only affected who? Gentiles. Right? Ultimately, whenever Moses is leading the people through the Red Sea, what happens to the Gentiles in the Red Sea? They're swallowed up in it. If Jesus is the new Moses, what would they be expecting? That he wouldn't have compassion on the Gentiles. And that if they're out in the desert region starving, that he's not going to do the same miracle he did that revealed that he was the new Moses. Because if he is the new Moses, then he would have a different reaction to these groups of this group of people. Is this making sense? See, the disciples not only have a prejudice against the Gentiles, but theologically, what Jesus is asking them, their question is coming, their confusion is coming out of a deeply embedded theology. If you are the new Moses, you will react to these people in a certain way. And feeding them the same way you did to the Jews is not exactly what we had in mind. Is this making sense? We've not stopped talking about the clean, unclean issue. They are deaf and dumb to what Jesus wants to do, and that's what fuels the question. But where in this desert, this wilderness, remember that place in the Jewish context connoted different ideas or alluded to different ideas of revolutions, the Maccabean Revolution, the Essene community, the messiahs of the early first century. That's what they were thinking. But not Gentiles. They're not the ones that are going to be a part of our army. They're the one our army is going to be geared against. Where in this desert region can anyone get enough bread to feed them? Jesus asked the same question. How many loaves do you have? 7, they replied. Huh. That's weird. Because in 2 verses, it also tells us they had a few small fish as well. But notice what in verse 7, notice what we don't get. What do we not get in reference to the fish there? A number. Why? Because the number 7 is more important. For Mark, how many exact pieces of food is not as important as getting to the number 7. When Jesus asked the question of how many loaves in the feeding of the 5,000, what was the response? We have 5 loaves and 2 fishes, Jesus. Oh, we get to the number 7. Here he asks how many loaves. They don't tell us how many fish. We have 7 loaves. Jesus says, perfect. Why? This number means completion. In other words, he says, perfect, we have just enough. We have the complete number of food that we need in order to feed the complete number of God's people. The number 7, getting to this number is more important in the Jewish mind than it is to tell us exactly how many pieces of food there were. Does that make sense? Numbers weigh more. They mean more whenever you weigh them in the Jewish mind than it does when you measure them. Measuring them is what we are obsessed with. Are the exact numbers in the Old Testament of how many armies were there exact? For a Jew, it's going, weighing them is way more important. Is a lot more important. Weighing them is a way more important. 7. He wants to get to the number 7. He told the crowd. He told the crowd to sit down on the ground. When he had given the 7 loaves, when he had taken the 7 loaves and given thanks, he broke them and gave them to his disciples to set before the people, and they did so. And you have to picture them reluctantly doing so. Go give these now to the dogs. Okay, but by definition, if they are dogs, why am I giving them a whole loaf?
Just do it.
But there is something that's important here that's also being roped together linguistically. There are actually three different meals that are being connected linguistically in this moment. The first one, and they're being connected through two key things, giving thanks and breaking of bread. Number one, the feeding of the 5,000. We have the word give thanks, eulogeo, which is the exact same word that's being used here in the feeding of the 4,000 of giving thanks, eulogeo. We have the breaking of bread, klao, Mark 6:41. It's the exact same word that's being used here in Mark 8:7, klao, same word. First of all, start off, why is that significant? We've already said it like 17 times. Significant because the first time eulogeo and klao were being used was in the context of Jewish territory. Now eulogeo and klao are being used in the breaking of bread. These two words, though, will appear one more time together inside of the Gospel of Mark, and I bet you can guess where. Where? Lord's Supper. Mark chapter 14, verse 22. The exact same words, eulogeo and klao, are used together. What is significant about that? Do not ask the question. The wrong question is, oh, is this the Lord's Supper then in chapter 8? No, it's not, because the Lord's Supper hasn't been instituted yet. But why the connection? Community. Explain that.
Because when we take communion together, that's what brings us together as one. And when the Gentiles and the Jews were doing that together with Jesus, that's what made them all as one.
Absolutely. That's exactly right. What we have here is this. The Lord's Supper inside of the church, more than any other moment, is a key symbol for unity. As a matter of fact, 1 Corinthians chapter 11, there's a major issue in the church of Corinth over the Lord's Supper. And what was it about? Does anybody know? What was happening?
They were getting drunk.
The rich Christians were getting so early to the festival. Because remember, the Lord's Supper back in the day just wasn't the little chicklet shot glass that we do every Sunday. In isolation. It was a communal moment where the whole community gets together and you sit at a meal and you eat a meal. And if you want to destroy bigotry or prejudice in any way, whether you're talking economic prejudice, gender prejudice, ethnic prejudice, best way to do it is over a meal. Best way to do it is over a meal. That's why I tell my Christian life class, you really want to take care of the poor? Don't just hand them money. Don't just hand them a sandwich. Invite them to a meal. And sit down with them face to face, eye to eye, and give them the dignity of actually having a relationship with someone that normally they don't even get a second glance from. You want to destroy prejudices in your church? Have potlucks every single week. And make sure that you don't have the cliques of the old or of the rich sitting in their sections and the poor and the young in theirs. But make sure they're intermingled. Why? Because whenever you sit across from somebody at a meal, you humanize them. You give them dignity. You see that they actually are people. It's one of the reasons why I absolutely love the name of Ted Decker and Carl Medeiros' book, Tea with Hezbollah. Tea is the same thing. When you sit across from someone at tea, you humanize them. And one of the most... Did I tell you guys about... I don't think I did. I'm reading a book right now called War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning by Chris Hedges. He's a war analyst where literally his job as a journalist is to go and to be on the front lines of wars. And he's addicted to it. The whole book is to talk about how war is literally a drug. And it's it develops a culture of war and that we have to keep intaking it, because if we don't, then we fall into triviality and we don't know how to find our identity without it. So he's actually arguing for the purpose of war. He is not a pacifist in any way, shape, or form. So don't think that that I'm just reading a bunch of pacifist junk and that's what's reinforcing my my beliefs in it. He's actually not at all. He says he's addicted to war. And it's one of the reasons why he was kicked out of Sarajevo 3 times because of death threats, and he had to keep going back because he couldn't get enough. He says this, though. He says this in the introduction. He says that whenever an empire is trying to develop a war, the voice that they are most, that they have to get rid of immediately in order for the war to actually happen, is not their enemy. They actually need their enemy, because the enemy just throws fuel on the fire and creates this big raging that eventually moves into a war. What they need to, what he said, what they need to get rid of first is the voices that humanize the enemy. He said, because if the voices that actually say things like love your enemy, or the voices that say things like the enemy actually are humans, are the voices that actually mitigates or militates against the war itself. Because in a war, we have to dehumanize the enemy so that when we kill them, we can see it as an act of mercy and not an act of cruelty. The first voices, he says, you have to get rid of are the ones that give dignity to the enemy from within inside your own camp. Is that, you seeing how dangerous this is? One of the reasons why the Jews are so upset with Jesus is because he's actually humanizing the Gentiles. And it makes their hatred towards them seem a lot less justifiable. It seems their violence towards the Gentiles a lot less justifiable when they're actually made in the image of God. It becomes a lot more difficult for them to do. And one of the things that meals do is it says, church, I want you to stare into the eyes of the people that you're prejudiced against. Because whenever you talk to them and you learn their story, all of a sudden you realize the struggles they've had in their lives, you've had in yours. You realize the reasons why they're acting the way they're acting is one of some, a lot of the same reasons why you're acting the way you're acting. And all of a sudden they become human. And some of the walls and the barriers of prejudice starts to fall down. And the reason why these three meals are linked, because ultimately they're building to the Lord's Supper. The moment in 1 Corinthians 11, the issue was the rich were mistreating the poor. And it's violating all that the Lord's Supper was about. Because it was creating disunity in the church. When it was supposed to be a meal, when it was unity. Matter of fact, he even brings up, he says, don't you know we take from one loaf? We are unified with one body because there's one loaf. Even the very emblems that we take, which is one of the reasons why I do get a little passionate about the mode of the Lord's Supper. Because what message is being communicated when we chop up all the loaf and the little pieces even before you have a chance to pull apart away from the body? What message are we communicating if all we have is little shot glasses and the individual... You're losing the key symbolic moments of the actual event. It's about unity. One cup, one bread. Because you are one body in Christ. I don't care, you can hear Paul saying this in Galatians 3. If you're male or female, slave nor free, Jew nor Gentile. At the foot of the cross, at the table of Jesus, we're all on the same level. And you have these three meals, one in Jewish territory, one in Gentile territory, ultimately are moving to the point when a new covenant is established in Jesus. And he says, you will be deaf and dumb, you will be blind and mute until you understand that what I'm doing both here and here is ultimately leading to this meal here. So to reduce this down to asking the question, is he doing the Lord's Supper, is missing the theological point. Because ultimately what it's saying is what happens to the Jews happens to the Gentiles, and ultimately all of them find unity in Jesus. Three meals. Is that making sense? Okay. I'm glad for the yeah, but it was almost like a shut up, Shane, move on. Okay. Yes, we get it. Okay, sorry. Verse, what are we at? Seven. They had a few small fish as well. Why count them? We've got our number seven. Moving on. He gave thanks for them also and told the disciples to distribute them. We're giving them manna and then some. Oh, these are dirty Gentiles. The people ate and were satisfied. Afterward, the disciples picked up seven basketfuls of broken pieces that were left over. Do not. How many basketfuls were picked up at the feeding of the 5,000? 12. How many are picked up here at the feeding of the 4,000? Do not say, oh, there was a lesser amount picked up, because these are lesser people. Weigh the numbers. What is 12 a number? What does it symbolically represent? Completion. What does 7 symbolically represent? Completion. You see the point? And one of the things Jesus rebukes the disciples whenever he's walking on the water at one point is he says, it's actually an aside note from Mark himself. He says they simply did not understand the meaning of the baskets, of the loaves. They didn't get it. They missed the number. Completion. Who is Jesus? He is the new Moses. Completion. Who is Jesus? The new Moses that does not wipe out the Gentiles but brings them in. Number 7 is very important. It's completion. The complete number of food that was needed in order to provide for the complete number of God's people. About 4,000 men were present. We talked about the significance of 5,000 men when we were at the feeding of the 5,000, right? What was that significance? Possibly, yes. That we were in this Jewish territory, but Jesus in the wilderness was developing His own legion. Now we're in Gentile territory. The same territory that the people begged Jesus to leave because of what happened with the pig swine in the comparison with the legions. And what finally, whenever, or not finally, but once they finally understand who Jesus is and we see how many there are, it's the same amount that we'd see for a Roman legion. Because a Roman legion could be anywhere from 2,000 to 6,000, although normally the Roman legion would always stay in the range of 4,000 to 6,000. This is the normal range, although it can dip down as low as this. Does that make sense? So you have 4,000 or 5,000 here, pointing possibly to a Roman legion, although in this context, it'd be much more explosive. And having sent them away, he got into the boat with his disciples and went to the region of Dalmanutha. And we'll talk about Dalmanutha tomorrow. Any questions? I'm giving you 5 minutes early today. I don't want to hear that I never gave you anything. All right, I love you. See you guys tomorrow.